Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Now, we have organized this forum into conversations consisting of three panels of speakers. The first panel will focus on the technology. The second panel will focus on some of the policies. And the third panel will focus on behavior, which I think may be a surprise to some of you, but this is going to be a key element in the success and the application of smart meters. The panels will be moderated by two people. The first two panels will be moderated by Martin Giles of The Economist. He's a senior economist there. And he writes about information technology and the smart grid. So we're fortunate to have him moderating. The second moderator will be Professor Andy Hargadon from UC Davis, who's been involved in the previous Roots events and has been intimately involved with some of the innovations in energy technology. So, during the discussion, I urge you to listen carefully and keep focused on future opportunities rather than present controversies. Try to imagine how the smart meter and the infrastructure behind and surrounding it can be used to engineer the next right turn, a downward turn in California's energy use. Also, you should know that we are videotaping and streaming this event as we have for previous events so that you can review some of the discussions later on. Now, I'm happy to present Martin Giles of The Economist and the first panel. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I will be looking at my BlackBerry every now and again. It's not because I'm working or I'm on deadline. It's to take your questions in. So if you see me doing that, please, I'm not being rude to any of our panelists or to you. Welcome to the Roots of Energy Efficiency, or the future Roots of Energy Efficiency, perhaps, as Alan pointed out. This is, as Nicole said, the third in a series of events on the history and future of energy efficiency in California. I'm Martin Giles. I'm the U.S. technology correspondent of The Economist. I do cover both the IT industry and smart grid as it interacts with the energy sector. And I'm going to be moderating the panel discussion on smart energy and the state of energy efficiency. And at The Economist, we like to say knowledge is power. And this is a great opportunity to bring knowledge and power together. So I'm very much looking forward to my discussion today. And I have three terrific panelists with me. To my right is Andrew Tang, who is the Senior Director of Pacific Gas and Electric Company's Integrated Demand Side Management Products team. To my far left, I have Warwick Sterling, who's responsible for driving and aligning corporate efforts on energy and sustainability globally at Whirlpool, which is the world's largest appliance manufacturer. And to my immediate left, I have Daniel Reicher, who's Director of Climate Change and Energy Initiatives for Google, Inc. And to start this panel, what I'd like to do is to just ask each one of my panelists in turn to make perhaps 4 or 5 minutes of opening comments about the subject of smart energy and the state of energy efficiency. Andrew, would you like to lead off?
Great. Thank you, Martin. So Pacific Gas and Electric is the combined gas and electric utility that's privileged to serve 15 million Californians across Northern and Central California. And we have a long history of promoting energy efficiency throughout the state. Really, over the past 30 years, our activities have resulted in the reduction of 155 million megawatt hours of electricity and 12.5 billion therms of natural gas being saved. In addition, we've been a pioneer with deploying two-way communicating smart meters. We have almost deployed 6 million to date. We have a total of 10 million in our service territory that we need to deploy. But today, these two technologies, when people talk about them, or when people talk about these two very large areas of study, they're really islands. They're really looked at very, very separately. The connection is just not there. It's just not immediately apparent with people. People think of smart meters, they'll think of demand response, but they won't understand what is the connection with energy efficiency. We have smart rates. We have rates that are time-based. But again, how does that promote energy efficiency? Energy efficiency in this state has been very, very successful. As I mentioned earlier, our contribution, the 155 million megawatt hours, to put that in context, that has offset the need for California to build 24 medium-sized power plants, 24 over the last 30 years. In addition, the amount of megawatt hour savings that we've saved over the last 30 years, another way to put it in context, is basically the equivalent of half of the electricity consumption of the entire state of California in 2009, or slightly over half. So energy efficiency is a big opportunity. There's a lot that we can do with energy efficiency. However, these very, very successful programs to date have really been, in the grand scheme of things, fairly low tech, right? It's been focused around weather stripping, around energy efficiency within appliances, appliance replacement to get people up to the Energy Star level categorization, compact fluorescent light bulbs to sunset out the incandescents, and codes and standards, building codes and whatnot to promote efficiency. However, the real potential here is to couple this with smart meter, because coupling this with smart meter only brings more knowledge, more information, and allows people to make informed decisions. To quote Martin's comment, that knowledge is power, right? We enable, by providing information, we allow knowledge to become power, we allow knowledge to become actionable. Some of the areas that we see that are exciting, that I believe the panel will talk about further, is really the areas of optimizing existing devices in our lives and looking at things in our lives as an end-to-end system. Right now, a lot of the energy efficiency measures are really point-to-point measures. Fix the windows, weather strip the windows, fix the refrigerator, look at the pool pump. Right? Very, very endpoint-oriented measures. And really, the opportunity is to look at this as a system. How do we live our lives? Right? What happens in the 24-hour time frame of each and every day, and how can you optimize that? And when you start putting it in that language, it actually starts becoming something that people in Silicon Valley are very used to, right? Optimization engines, all sorts of how do we use technology, a lot of technologies that are already existing and developed and off the shelf today, how can we use those technologies to optimize the devices that we interact with in order to generate that next generation of energy efficiency?
Thank you. That's great. Warwick, would you?
So, good afternoon. As Martin said, work for Whirlpool. We actually have Maytag, KitchenAid, some other brands like that. We are the world's largest appliance manufacturer. So, we've spent a long time on energy efficiency and trying to make our refrigerators, our dishwashers, and our washing machines much more efficient products. And so, as we look forward, and we're asked to talk about the future here, as we look forward, we see connected or smart appliances as sort of the next generation of energy-efficient appliances. So as we look at the various technologies out there, having a connected appliance is going to allow us to reach a new level of efficiency. One of the things I wanted to point out is most people, when they talk about smart grid, talk about the supply side of the equation. So you talk about renewables, you talk about wind, solar, high-voltage lines, smart meters. I think we have to remember the demand side of the equation as well. And that's where appliances fit in. Appliances represent over 50% of the residential energy consumption. And so it's a huge energy consumer within the home. And as homes become more efficient in terms of the shell and the windows and things like that, the appliances are going to represent an even bigger portion of that energy consumption. So, you know, I really do, Whirlpool really believes that appliances should be an integral part of this demand side of the equation. They really feel like the appliances should be a piece, an active piece of the grid. I also wanted to talk a little bit about, we also talk a lot about the meter as sort of the path to the home. There's this thing that was invented a little while ago called the internet, and we quite like the idea of leveraging the internet as well to talk to the home. The internet actually talks to the home today, and so we don't necessarily see the deployment of meters as a bad thing, but we also don't see it as a gating factor to actually getting connected homes becoming more energy efficient. I mean, our view is let's use the internet, and when the meters come along, we'll use the meter as well. If we're going to do that, though, we do require common standards, protocols within the home So you need common communication standards, common protocols, so that it can all interoperate properly. And then the last piece, Whirlpool has a lot of experience with consumers and how they use their appliances. And so consumer behavior, I think, is a super critical piece here. If consumers don't buy connected appliances, or they don't connect them, or they don't use them in the right way, then we really can't get those energy efficiency savings. So consumer behavior and usability is just a really, really important piece of this equation.
Okay, thank you. Dan.
Thank you, Mark, Martin, Andy, Warwick. Good afternoon. Before I get to my main points, I'd like to address the elephant in the room that could really drive serious changes in our energy economy, including an expanded focus on energy efficiency, and I'm referring to the recent Gulf oil disaster. I served on the commission that investigated the Three Mile Island accident as a staff member, and as I think many of you know, we made significant changes to the way we regulate nuclear power and the technology that lies behind nuclear power, and we have a safer nuclear industry as a result of it. I'm hopeful we'll see something similar when it comes to the safety of offshore oil. But even more fundamentally, I think we have one of those teachable moments where we can focus the nation on the extraordinary opportunity to reduce our dangerous oil dependence and take advantage of broader energy efficiency opportunities. So I really think it's important that we understand that highly unusual context today. Now, whether it's drilling for oil deep under the ocean, splitting atoms in a reactor, or most relevantly, improving the efficiency of energy use, progress towards a more sustainable energy future requires action at all three points of what I like to call the clean energy triangle. We've got to advance clean energy technologies through research, development, and demonstration. We've got to put the right policies in place at all levels to accelerate deployment, and we've got to ensure there's adequate capital across the entire spectrum from early stage R&D to full commercialization. And the good news is that energy efficiency can be advanced more rapidly than any other energy technology using these three levers. It is, as we know, the low-hanging fruit, and the good news about low-hanging fruit is that it indeed grows back. You don't use up energy efficiency opportunities with the arrival of new technologies. At Google, we're working at all three points of this clean energy triangle. We've got an engineering team working on a variety of things. One, for example, how do you take the costs out of the large mirrors that are at the core of solar thermal systems in the desert? Our policy team is pushing for the development of a new agency in Washington called the Clean Energy Deployment Administration that would help us bridge this valley of death, as we call it, that sits between the invention of a technology and its full-scale commercial deployment. And our investment team is putting money to work not only in green energy technology companies, but increasingly in clean energy projects as well. And not surprisingly, we were very interested in this intersection between energy technology and information technology, as we say, ET meets IT. One example is Google Power Meter, which is software we've developed that gets people real-time or near real-time information about their home energy use, either getting that data from a smart meter or alternatively from the increasing number of devices that are available today that can be, for example, clipped on your fuse box. And Power Meter actually, it really works. It's quite amazing. One of my colleagues, tiny little apartment in San Francisco, installed this, kept seeing these big spikes and determined that he was paying for all the washers and dryers in his basement. Another colleague discovered that her pool pump had been operating nonstop for 5 years. You'll learn a lot. We're also very interested at Google in what will be the largest appliance in the home, and that is, in fact, the plug-in car. We've built a fleet of them at Google. We've been testing them over the last few years, and it's quite amazing. An aftermarket plug-in Prius that gets over 90 miles per gallon, a Ford Escape plug-in that gets 50 miles per gallon. We've also done some work initially on the software that you need to integrate large numbers of these vehicles into the grid, avoiding that day in California several years from now when it's 95 degrees out and everybody comes home and there are millions of plugs in and plug-in cars and plugs into the grid at the same moment and the grid goes down. So, now I was asked several questions in preparing my opening remarks. One was whether smart meters and smart appliances at the consumer level and smart installations at the commercial level are having an impact on our energy consumption. Another even more important question that Alan Meyer, who you heard from earlier, asked was whether smart meters can be transformed into a new route of energy efficiency. As he said to us, can a system installed to reduce peak power use also save electricity and natural gas all the time? Not just peak, but can it be useful all the time? The quick answer to the first question is that we are moving too slowly in smartening up our energy system, and sadly, the impacts are far more modest today than they can and should be. With regard to the second question, smart meters could become a new route of energy efficiency, but we have a long way to go. For the most part, smart meters that have been installed are not providing nearly the energy efficiency benefits they could, even though they are helping utilities in other ways. For example, having to log onto a utility website to get home energy use data is a pretty high hurdle for most people. That's one of the reasons why we've built Google Power Meter and give it away for free, and why we believe that having home energy information on a home page that people visit several times a day for news, for weather, for sports, for the stock quotes, can really make a difference in energy efficiency. I should also note that when it comes to cutting home energy use, there are a rising number of alternatives to smart meters. As Warwick mentioned, companies of all stripes are building simple devices that people can use to monitor energy use without a utility smart meter, and that can often provide information closer to real time. That's why we've also built Power Meter to talk to these devices as well, not just to smart meters. There are some important policy considerations here. While California has certainly made progress in incentivizing utilities to promote efficiency, most utilities in most places still make more money selling energy to customers than helping them save it. We need to continue to press for policy reforms across the U.S. that alter this equation. Equally important, many utilities in many places are still resisting competition, often strongly. I would note that on Tuesday, Californians said no to Proposition 16, which would have made it harder for communities to set up their own power companies, which may be better positioned to promote energy efficiency than investor-owned utilities. Looking ahead, new policy at the federal and state level will have a lot to say about how fast and how far we can deploy energy efficiency, especially enabled by smart technology. Obviously, a price on carbon emissions would help, but short of that, there are many other important measures. Aggressive national and state energy efficiency resource standards, stronger appliance efficiency standards, and significant financial incentives to purchase efficient appliances and equipment. And at Google, we're pushing hard for federal and state laws and regulations that establish a consumer right to know electricity consumption information, including a recent bill introduced in the U.S. House by Congressman Markey. We've also been pressing for similar reforms that the California Public Utility Commission is considering. Finally, at a very practical and significant level, the arrival of smart appliances and plug-in cars could provide a real boost to smarter energy use. In the case of appliances, there could be a lot more interest in smart meters and other energy monitoring devices if they were talking to smart home appliances and thereby helping to better manage energy use and increase efficiency. Does it really matter whether your dishwasher runs at 6 p.m. on a hot day when the grid is maxed out, or 6 a.m. in the cool of the following morning as long as the dishes are cleaned by breakfast? And imagine what it could mean for energy efficiency if you got a regular signal about how efficiently your refrigerator or air conditioner was operating and whether it needs service or replacement. And with the arrival of plug-in cars, we could have even greater benefits for the grid by managing when and how they charge. Remember, these cars not only plug into the electric grid, they are also going to plug into the internet. In a world with smart cars, smart appliances, and smart meters, we will better be able to manage what will hopefully be vastly increased quantities of solar and wind into the grid. These are intermittent energy sources. As we know, the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And rather having to turn to traditional power plants, turn them on and off in order to integrate them into the grid, we believe we will instead be able to manage the charging and operations of millions of devices connected to the grid. At Google, we've coined the term for this demand dispatch. In California, the wind often blows more at night than during the day, when we least need it. Imagine millions of cars plugged in, online, and waiting to be filled up. Could we be talking about a real alternative to more offshore oil drilling? I hope so. Thanks very much.
So if I could summarize your presentation, it would be on the point of smart meters, disappointing, and it's the utility's fault. I think I got that in one, didn't I? Andrew, no, it's disappointing and it's all your fault. How do you view that?
So when you actually break down the challenge and say, okay, we've got 10 million meters to deploy and we've got about 3.5 or 4 years to deploy it.
In California.
In California.
Yeah, well, let's forget about Texas.
I'm talking about
California.
Pacific Gas and Electric Company, right?
Yeah.
You start breaking down that challenge and you say, why can't we do it faster? Well, you start working the math out and you realize that we are now deploying something like between 15,000 to 20,000 meters a day.
Right.
Some of those meters, by necessity, in particular the gas meters, by necessity, actually has some installer input that has to happen. They have to look at what the existing gas meter is, and they have to make some setting adjustments to the new meter to replace it. So I take the point that that our business model maybe doesn't scale as fast as some of these advertising-based business models that Silicon Valley has gotten very used to. We do not have eyeball, our eyeball count can't get to, 10 million in 3 days. And we're kind of rooted to the grassroots of, we got 900 people out there every day going from premise to premise, popping a meter off and popping a meter back in, and we're doing about 15,000 a day. As far as services that we can offer, we get in this internal debate a lot, which is at what point do you start to advertise the types of features and advances and the great things that the knowledge of more granular data about your consumption, when do you start to advertise that? When do you actually start to really make that push? Because again, we serve all of northern or good portions of northern and southern California. We've got like 70,000 square miles in our service territory. When you buy media buys or you try to start advertising something, is it when you're 50% through that you can start turning on the juice and have 50% of your customers disappointed because they don't have it yet? Is it 20% or is it 75%? Right. So there's a balancing act.
Right.
One of the things we did just announce today, is something called Energy Alerts. And so, in California, as part of policy and part of the reason when you look at the energy efficiency graphs, one of the reasons why we've got the per capita consumption flat is because we have progressive rates we have inclining block rates. We have increasing marginal cost on electricity. The more you consume, the more expensive it gets. Well, one of the features we thought, historically, and it's been a great policy, but if you think about it, if you think of carrots and sticks as far as ways to incent behavior, and I know there's a panel coming up that will talk all about energy behavior, but if you think about carrots and sticks, this has been a baseball bat.
Got it.
Not a stick, a bat, right? And so, and the reason is because you consume all your electricity over 30 days. It takes us maybe 5 to 10 days to get your bill out.
Right.
You get a bill and you say, what did I do 10 to 40 days ago? Because I used too much electricity. What can I do different, right?
Right.
And there's nothing you can do to change your bill. Your bill is what it is because you used what you used. You can't go back into the past. So our Energy Alerts product, actually, that we just launched today, will actually alert our customers. If you sign up for it, you can either get an SMS text message or an email or a call whenever you cross over into the various price tiers.
Got it.
Right? And so this way, you actually have data that through the course of your billing cycle, you can say, I better change my behavior.
So if I were to summarize your point there to Dan, it would be, it's complicated, it's big, it's really something you can't rush because consumer behavior has to be taken into account and change. Both of you, how do you both react to that? What do you think?
I think my point was more about service. Let's make sure as quickly as we can to maximize the service benefits. PG&E is doing a significant amount of smart meter installation.
Yeah.
I was speaking broadly across the country. I would hope that there would be a lot of other utilities that would catch up with that pace. So mine is much more of a focus on what
What can we do in the meantime?
When the smart meter gets installed, how good is it in terms of providing service?
Right.
How can we make it better?
Right.
For the very large number of homes that either that don't have smart meters and may never get them around the country, around the world, what are the other devices? So it's really, how do we, with and without smart meters, how do we quickly and significantly improve energy information for people in their homes?
Okay. Warwick, you mentioned the internet when you were talking in your opening comments and how important you saw this. How do you view smart meter versus other tools that could be used?
So I think that I agree with Dan that the smart meter is just a single tool, and there are other tools. And you know, he is trying to do 15,000 a day, so he's working hard. But we do have the internet today, so let's use the internet. Let's use some of these other tools, and I think the portfolio of tools will get us there. So I don't necessarily see the meter as a sort of the only solution. I think there are other solutions. But then I agree. I think it comes down to starting to train consumers. I mean, I really like the idea of having an energy alert and starting to train consumers to be proactive in their use of energy. I mean, there's one thing to alert them. There's a second thing to tell them what to do, because if I tell you, for example, your refrigerator is using too much energy, I mean, a show of hands, who knows what to do when your refrigerator starts using too much energy? Okay, so there's like a couple of you. Yeah, you can turn it off. Somebody said turn it off. So the world's most efficient refrigerator is the one that's turned off. But it doesn't really help with food preservation. So, I mean, I think as an appliance manufacturer, we also have to start to provide consumers the ability to react to this information. So while they might get this information, they need to be able to have the tools to easily either delay the use of the dishwasher to a more efficient time period, or to be able to automatically manage their refrigerator's energy consumption.
Right. I mean, a point to both of you, I guess you could look at this and say, yes, the internet would be very powerful, but you know, broadband still doesn't reach large percentages of certain parts of our community. So, you know, low-income residents, elderly, etc. They're used to meters.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that it's not an either-or, and it's not a one
sure.
or the other.
Sure.
Right? We are in an environment where if you want to get the, you know, reach the maximum number of households, we have a mixed network topology that we're going to have to deal with. That the greater ecosystem is going to have to deal with. There's going to be multiple ways of doing it, whether it's wireless internet, you know, whether it's wired internet, whether or not there's an alternate path through the utility.
In fact,
the utilities are not really, you know, they're not looking to create another broadband pipe into the home, right? I mean, this is our cash register. Right? And this is our way of getting control signals out, and we're pulling very interesting information about in terms of now offering hourly data in our case, but you know, offering hourly data
right.
as opposed to monthly data. Right. So think about it like getting a credit card bill. Historically, you know, if you get a credit card bill and it says $700 and that's it, right? That's like your utility bill today.
Yes.
Maybe it's not $700, but that's your utility bill today, right? No itemization whatsoever, right? The future is more like, you know, having that itemized credit card bill where you say, oh, I spent this much on this and I spent that much on that, whereas now you'd have the ability to say, oh, I spent this much during this week and this much during this week. Hey, you know, does that make sense? I thought I was on vacation that week. Right.
But and the opportunity here is go from daily to hourly. I don't have a smart meter in my home in the East Bay. We have a little device that we clip down the fuse box and I get instantaneous information. So it was quite extraordinary. I knew I had an old furnace in the house, but in this mild climate, I ran the numbers. Didn't make sense to change it out very soon. But I kept seeing this big spike, and it was the electric motor that runs the blower. It turns out it's 40 years old. And for next to nothing, I can just replace that electric motor. My six-year-old was standing looking at our instantaneous meter one day, and he put a slice of bread in the toaster. Our normal on is, you know, 200 watts. It shoots up to 2,000 watts. Talk about a teachable moment.
That's a hell of a toaster.
Yeah, it's my grandmother's toaster.
Oh, okay.
It's an ancient beast. And boy, did it, and my son finally understood what, you know, comes through the wall and how that gets turned into heat. So anyway, the point is that, you know, hourly is improvement, but instantaneous. And that's where we really need to get. Because, boy, you show people immediately what's going on. And you follow up with real information about the next step to take.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because you don't realize you've got this, you know, 40-year-old toaster that uses 2,000 watts and you kind of really need a new KitchenAid wine, or you've got an old water heater. We can negotiate a discount.
We gave him that one. That's the last one.
But it's true. I mean, people have these 40-year-old refrigerators. You know, the refrigerator never dies and it uses, you know, a megawatt. And so... but people don't know, so you're right, you can't make that economic trade-off to be able to say, okay, how much money am I going to be able to save by replacing my old refrigerator,
and when's
the right time to do it?
But Andrew made a point about islands, you're saying we have these islands, and let's say we are getting this information somehow or other through various routes that comes into the home. We're assuming that people will act on it. How do we join up those islands? Should there be some kind of reach-in from PG&E or from Whirlpool, Google even? How active should you all be in trying to make sure that Texas never catches up with California, which is pretty important, and that California makes that right turn that Alan talked about?
I mean, from my point of view, I mean, we advertise and talk to consumers every day, so does Google. So does PG&E. I don't actually think it's one of us doing it. It's actually all of us doing it. But when we do it, we have to have sort of a common set of messages. I don't think it helps if one says go left and the other says go right. I think we all have to be aligned. And I think the biggest challenge is going to be consumer education. I mean, we see that every day. We make improvements to our appliances, and then trying to explain those improvements to the appliances is very challenging. And so the same is true with energy efficiency. It's just not top of mind for a lot of consumers, and so we have to explain that to them.
Yeah, from our standpoint, we spend in California, we spend a considerable amount of money on energy efficiency rebates, right? And so we're trying to create economic incentives for people, or make the equation, to the extent that people run the equation, to make the equation even easier to switch out that refrigerator or to switch out that HVAC unit or whatever the device may be. But I think that's part of the equation, right? That's maybe part of the economics part of the equation.
Yeah.
There's this whole element of behavior management, and how do you get that information out to users?
Yes.
Right? And I won't for a minute, pretend that an electric and gas utility can be the enlightened party that should be leading that charge, right? But I think that we can be partners. That can be leading that charge, and people, like the Googles of the world, like the L-Powers of the world, there's a third panel session here today on behavior management. Right?
But how would that partnership
work? It's the awareness.
What would that mean, though, concretely, to achieve this energy efficiency gain? What role would you play, and what role would Google play?
Well, I think it's sharing of the data, and it's combined mining of the data and looking at what the data can offer to our customers.
Right.
Yeah, and I guess to me, there's sort of three pieces to how you get people to act. One is policy, so they, in fact, don't have to make their own decisions. You set standards for the efficiency of refrigerators that take them from 2,000 kilowatt hours a year to a maximum of 450 kilowatt hours a year.
Right. We'll pick that up in the next panel.
That happens. That gets instituted automatically. The second is, in fact, information, getting them information as much as possible, real time, simple, and particularized to their own home or business. Tell me what I can do. What are the top three things in my own home that would really make a difference, and what will it cost, and how do I go about making those changes?
Right.
And the third is, in fact, behavioral. You don't always have to change things out in a home or in a business. I think about what we could do with kids in schools. In many ways, kids taught their parents to stop smoking. Kids taught their parents to recycle. They learn things in school. I think there's a budding opportunity here just beginning to be explored where kids learn about energy in schools and go home and teach their parents the same.
Right.
So it's a combination of things.
And Warwick, I want to ask you, what do you hear from your customers in terms of their desire to manage appliances? I mean, do they really want to be able to sort of set the consumption levels at particular times of your washer dryers or whatever? Or what sort of messages are you getting back from?
I think there are a couple of Google engineers who love to set their washing machine very complexly, but the majority of, the majority of consumers, I mean, they're really busy. They just want to press one button, and say go. I mean, they don't really want to think about it. It's a dishwasher. They want it to wash the dishes. It's a refrigerator. They want it to stay cold. I mean, it's not an iPod. They're not trying to play with it. They're not trying to program it. It's not a VCR. It just needs to be really, really simple. So I think we have to do a lot of the heavy lifting for the consumer. And they have busy lives, and these are tools to, they're productivity tools. And I think we can't make the productivity tool less productive by having all these buttons and knobs and dials and things.
Right, I would absolutely agree. You know, we have a very unique population here in the Bay Area, right? Very high percentage of engineers, very high percentage of people that are very aware and very environmentally conscious. But I think we need to, you know, as I think what Silicon Valley really needs to focus on and think about is how do you make these behavioral changes automatic for people, right? Kind of a set and forget. So Dan talked about, you know, plug-in electric vehicles. How do we make sure that when people come home from work and it's, you know, one of those days, 95 degrees and California's running out of power, and they all, you know, they all think, well, this is a car. This isn't electricity. This is a car, right? Let me go plug it into the wall. And we don't have, you know, rolling blackouts because all of a sudden there's all this, you know, there's a huge increase in load from all the electric vehicles. It's really got to be about kind of policy-based decisions, right? I mean, if we think of our homes getting smarter and think of like a George Jetson's, you know, future, the home of the future, I mean, we're not too far away from it. And, you know, many of the companies in Silicon Valley have developed technologies that are capable of doing this. I mean, this is not it's not a very large IT challenge. It's really a very large challenge of how to get it out deployed into the field and how to get people to embrace it.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, Whirlpool, Google, are you working on products that could help us literally have home management systems that integrate every aspect to join the smart meter to the appliances?
Well, so Power Meter, that our piece of software, as it progresses, is going to have more and more capabilities.
Okay.
And one of those that, you know, we'd like to get to a point where, in fact, it can tell you what subsystems are doing, get to a point where it helps you make choices. I mean, I agree with what Andy said, set and forget. That's a really important way to proceed. If, as I said, you know, you don't really care when the dishes get washed between when you finish dinner, as long as they're ready by the next morning and
right.
The load is clean. And if partway through the night it's cheaper and it's greener, what the heck? So that, but limiting complexity in that is really important. And I think the software that Silicon Valley and others is putting together could take us a long distance in taking advantage of that opportunity.
Yeah, our view is, I mean, there are a lot of companies out there, some in Silicon Valley, some elsewhere, that are actually developing energy management solutions for the home. And essentially what we'd want to do is be able to play in all of those, interoperate in all of those systems. So we don't know who's going to win, whether it's going to be Google or somebody else, but we'd like to play in that environment.
I was just going to say, that's a sort of nightmare scenario for you, though, because you could see 3, 4, 5 different systems being pitched. You're going to have to build some kind of interoperability in your machines. No?
Well, yes, but that's,
I mean, why standards are
yeah,
so
Yeah, we're right. opened up talking about standards, right? I mean, there is standards activity work happening, and that's being led by NIST, right?
Right.
And it's on a national basis, but it has to be on at least a national basis, right? Otherwise, the model doesn't scale.
Right. Talking of national basis, I mean, Dan, you Google sent a letter along with a number of other companies recently to the president, saying, President Obama, we believe this is something that requires federal attention and that there should be federal rules about power, information sharing, how this information is gathered and used. What drove you to write that letter?
Well, I think there's a variety of motivations. One, you do, in fact, need, as Andy said, at least a national approach to some aspects of that. So, for example, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, is the standard-setting body that's going to really help try to rationalize how all these products and devices and appliances and meters talk to each other. And so we don't have too much of a crazy quilt. So that's one piece. Secondly, though, we do feel as though and this is, in fact, what we've pressed for with lots of others, and there's now legislation introduced, as I said, that there ought to be some sort of a national right to know home energy consumption information. You know, there are places where it's hard to get, and there are places easier to get. California is already taking some steps to make this kind of information more accessible to people, but there are lots of states that aren't.
Right.
And just a simple right of access is a good way to start to sort of accelerate the use of smart meters, to accelerate interest in smart appliances, to make sure that when we do have the arrival of these plug-in vehicles, people have the information they need to manage them well and make smart decisions.
Right. And is that something you sympathize with?
Or? Yeah, I mean, yeah. I would agree. And I think I would further by saying that, you know, my exposure or my knowledge of this topic is really limited to my state,
right.
California. And I would say that I think that we are taking the, you know, led by the CPUC, we're taking the appropriate steps to understand the issue on access to data by third parties is specifically being addressed in an order instituting rulemaking right now at the commission.
Yep.
And you know, it's a stakeholder process. It's a process where I think all the stakeholders, not just the Googles and the investor-owned utilities, but really everyone, you know, needs to be able to comment on what are the rules of that road.
Right.
But the road is clear, right?
Right?
The road is clear. There's going to be some, I mean, there is some level of, customers own their data,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And customers should, so the logical conclusion of that is customers should absolutely be able to assign that ownership of that data to a third party to do what that third party wants to do.
And those third parties are really important to this.
And those third parties are important to achieving
now,
this.
Now, not all utilities feel that way.
I was just going to say that's a pretty unusual position, right?
So you take a sampling across this country,
yeah.
And you would not necessarily have that view. Thus, the push for federal legislation to make sure that there is, in fact, that interest, that willingness across the country in providing access to third parties on a thoughtful, agreed-upon basis.
I think it's super important that this sort of state-by-state versus national. I mean, you know, Whirlpool makes 20,000 dryers a day in one of its factories, and if you said, well, you know, 1,000 of those are going to go to California and 1,000 of those are going to go to Texas, it becomes a total nightmare for us from an economic point of view. So, I mean, national standards are really important. State preemption is going to be challenging. So.
Right. I want to take a couple of questions that have come in from the floor. One asks, I think it's an excellent question, from John, who says, will current smart meters that are being installed now, will they be obsolete within 2 to 4 years? Will we find that the technology, I mean, it's not like the old meters that were in, that was it, you could leave them, like mine that has cobwebs all over it, it's probably been there for like 50 years. These things, the technology is moving so fast, will we find that we're constantly changing smart meters, and what does that mean for third parties that have to interact with them?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we were looking at the smart meter architecture and looking at the various vendors, you know, future product obsolescence was actually a very, very big concern and very topical for us. And obviously, we've got this interesting collision between, you know, I guess everyone says ET and IT. IT, a design cycle or a life cycle, might be, you know, as short as 6 months or as long as 18 months, right? But it's clearly in months, whereas the design cycle in a utility is, it's kind of still that same 6 to 18 or maybe 12 to 18 years.
Right.
So there is definitely a. I mean, our assets are very long lived. I mean, that's just the premise behind the utility business. So when we looked at it, we said, okay, so how do you future proof this, right? And so the things we looked at was putting on more onboard memory onboard the actual meter, and really looking at a distributed architecture so that the smart meter does what it needs to do, which is meter the premise and tell us how much electricity is being used, meter it in two directions, right, so that we can take advantage of the future of bi-directional electricity flows, and really serve as a, you know, potentially serve as a through point to whatever happens in the home. The smart meter could be the gateway, or another device in the home could be the gateway, and that device in the home that's the gateway could ultimately hook up to the internet. So we're looking at it that we have a certain amount of future-proofness into it,
right.
Because you can always use you can, you know it serves its function, and you can always go into the house to get more functionality.
Got it. I would just quickly add that as we've gone around the country and looked at the state of meters and smart meters, they differ dramatically, and our ability for our software to talk to those meters differs dramatically, and the mm-hmm. communication systems that the meters do or don't have can differ dramatically.
Right.
So it makes for a bit of a crazy quilt situation,
yes.
When you're trying to sort of design something that can be applied broadly. Having said all that, I would emphasize again, the question was about the world of smart meters. There is this whole other world of pure devices outside the utility context.
Yep.
And there are small companies of all sorts that are producing these devices. Stay tuned. Some very big players with very big names are going to be entering the in-home energy device side of this equation as well. So you may be getting your information through a smart meter, but you may be getting it by through a different device not connected to your utility.
I just want to follow up. There's a question from the floor from Derek who asks, how specific, how granular does the information have to be that's being delivered and recommendations through smart energy systems to the end user to actually really cause this right-hand turn to occur? I mean, is there a risk that there's sort of overload, data overload?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we talked earlier about having lots of knobs on your fridge. There can absolutely be data overload. But that comes down to appliance manufacturers, other manufacturers innovating to do it on behalf of the consumer. So
right.
I think there's certainly information that's value-added. We were talking about pool pumps and people paying for other people's washing machines. I think that information is very valuable. But it needs to be delivered in such a way that the consumer can easily absorb that information and make a behavior change.
I think granularity is important. And generally, the more granular, the better. The more real-time, the better. But the balance is not to overwhelm people.
Yeah.
And again, to extract from that information the very particularized, very practical things that individuals can do in their own homes and not overwhelm them.
So what you want is something that's very sort of complex underneath but has a very simple interface on the top of it. So I can see the Apple dishwasher emerging in the not-too-distant future. Steve Jobs, are you listening? No competition, sorry. No competition.
A little bit nervous if Apple has that market.
I wash.
The I wash.
Trademark that right now.
Ooh, Andy,
that's good, isn't it? You heard it here first.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just have to figure out how to spell I.
Yeah. Yes. So back to something more less flippant, but actually very, very important issue. I wanted to just ask Dan, you talked about the plug-in car, the plug-in electrification is everywhere. Andy talked about risk of brownouts, etc. Are we in danger of actually giving people actionable information that changes their behavior in certain ways? But you could see, for example, I can run all of these great things that I'm going to get at low power because now I can see where off-peak is. Great, that's really cheap, the off-peak. And oh my word, the peak power now is really expensive. So what I will do is I'll go for the off-peak. Everyone's going to go for the off-peak. And they're going to buy a lot more because it's cheap. It's really cheap. What happens? Might the whole system collapse?
So everyone going for the off-peak, I think, would be great. And I think there's a real challenge as to whether or not that would really, really turn the curve.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
On vehicles in particular, for instance, one of the national labs did a study and showed that if you could wave a wand overnight and change all the light-duty vehicle fleet all to electric vehicles instantly, that we'd have enough excess generating capacity in the overnight period to power 72% of the existing U.S. fleet, right? So there is a lot of excess power.
Yeah.
There is a lot of excess power. Now, there is an issue on the utility front, which is, our systems are designed more or less to have some period of time where they get to cool off. Right? So there's a little bit of a reliance on, or there's somewhat of a reliance on this cool-off period where in the nighttime they're not being driven quite as high. But the difference between peak daytime peak load and overnight off-peak load can be 2x or greater.
Right.
Right?
Really?
So there's this is a steep busy hour curve, right?
Right.
My quick response is as problems go, it would be one of our better problems to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pushing this into the nighttime. And, as I said, the place like California where we have this extraordinary wind resource, but a lot of it comes at night, that's a real opportunity to fill up those plug-in cars.
Yes.
I think I wanted to talk about peak a little bit. People talk about sort of summer peaks, and they talk about it, it's 6 hours a year or it's 15 days or something like that. I mean, the way we're looking at it is, and I think Dan said it earlier, This is an ongoing thing that happens every single day, and we can actually smooth the entire load curve, which will make PG&E's work a lot easier if we smooth the entire curve.
Right.
I think there's sort of this perception that we're only trying to problem solve on a handful of hot days a year. You know, yeah. It's the hot days a year or the cold days a year, and we're going to problem solve those. I would argue it's 365 days a year, and we're trying to smooth the load curve,
right,
which will make the entire system a lot more efficient.
Got it. I'll ask you a question earlier on. When you build in this new capability that will enable us to link our appliances with the smart grid, are you going to make them cheaper, or is this going to cost more? And if it's going to cost more, which I sneakingly suspect it might, what would the ROI be for a consumer? How will you convince me that the ROI is there for paying a premium for my?
I was going to say, you're joking. We're going to sell these things for less money. With the right incentives from Andy, yeah, we can sell it for whatever price you want. We can give them away for free if Andy helps us with
I
that.
I see. Andy, would you like to do that?
I can make a business case for it. We'll see.
So, I mean, I think the way we look at it is that initially, for the initial wave of appliances, there might be a slight premium, but from an ROI point of view, there needs to be a payback within a couple of years.
Yep.
And then that leads you to start to talk about time-based rates. You talked about sort of inclining block rates, yep, in terms of pricing. There needs to be, I wouldn't say price is the only incentive, I think there are other incentives, but there needs to be an economic incentive for consumers, at least on that dimension. And so differential pricing based,
right,
on time of day will actually change the behavior. Flat rate pricing is very difficult for us to make the case that, you know, you need to do demand response.
And whose job is it to do that selling of that? Is it yours? Is it Andy's? Is it?
I think it's a combination. I mean, there needs to be the policies in place which allow Andy to be able to change the rates so,
right,
that you do have this differentiated rate structure. And then you need the appliance manufacturers and others to be able to show the consumer how they can take advantage of that.
Right. Well, and in states like California and others that have efficiency requirements, that the Public Utility Commission has a role to play there in making sure that the right rate structures get set up to provide this kind of incentive and differential.
Right.
So a lot has to be brought together. The good news is a lot of that can happen in California, is happening somewhat.
Yep.
The bad news is in large parts of the rest of the country, it isn't.
Right.
So I think initial markets are going to be in states like California, where also electricity prices tend to be higher.
Got it.
So
I'd like to give you all just 1 minute each, just to sum, and I mean 1 minute, so we can get everybody off to, right, but who would just like to make some closing observations or statements? Anybody want to start? Andy, go on.
Wait, I started the first session.
we'll let you go last.
I don't mind starting. I mean, I think this discussion sort of highlights that it's not Andy's problem or Google's problem or Whirlpool's problem. It's sort of a collective problem. And it requires many stakeholders to get involved. I mean, the PUC needs to get involved. The utilities need to be involved. There needs to be innovation from the manufacturers. We haven't talked about retail partners yet getting involved and educating consumers, and then companies like Google. So I think it's a complex problem because we're not asking one company to solve it or one industry to solve it. We're asking multiple industries, thousands of companies to solve this problem. And so, you know, I think it is a big challenge, and I think these kinds of forums help get everybody aligned and on the same page in terms of what's their role and what do they need to do,
right,
so that I have a better idea of what Whirlpool should be doing, what the utility should be doing, and so I know my role so,
yeah,
I can get this to happen.
Dan.
I would say, I would add to that, the good news, though, is that it is, in fact, a tractable, a solvable problem. I think the good news is we've actually got a lot of technologies here now ready to be deployed. And if we could work our way further around that triangle of technology, policy, and finance and really put the policy mechanisms in place, make sure there's adequate capital to make this transformation. Unlike so many other things where we're looking at decades to improve the technologies, here we've got much of it today.
Right.
On the hardware side and increasingly on the software side, and we can make some dramatic changes with some big economic security and environmental benefits. So,
terrific. Thank you.
And I would just say, you know, I'm actually really excited about this future. I think there is tremendous promise. I mean, if you think about the is this the beginning of the third route for energy efficiency? Can we make another right turn? I think the answer is absolutely yes. I think that we should broaden it, though, from smart meters. You know, smart,
yep,
meters is an enabling technology. There are many enabling technologies. It will play a role,
yeah,
but it is not the sole equipment to take us into this next future. But I think that this collision that everyone talks about between ET and IT is absolutely here among us, and the opportunity is right before us.
I will.
These
I will.
Are,
Go ahead.
These are, you know, and in many cases, right, these are existing technologies with software algorithms or thought optimization engines that have been done before to solve other problems, you know, whether it be telecom problems or enterprise management problems or other problems, right? And it's just adapting it now to electrons
right.
instead of data packets.
Some of my colleagues in the room will groan when they hear this because they've heard it before, but one of my favorite moments in the Clinton administration was shortly after President Clinton gave his second inaugural address, which was about building a bridge to the 21st century. We set some new standards at the Energy Department related to refrigerators, and we announced publicly that we were building a fridge to the 21st century.
Well, with that, I'd like to build a fridge to the break. Ladies and gentlemen, please would you thank
well
my
done.
Panelists.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Great. Well done. Great.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.